and an issue for all women.
Hello, hey and hi there. Welcome to episode 11 of the Standard Issue Podzine. I'm Mickey Noonan and I once ate a starfish. I'm joined by...
I'm Hannah Dunleavy, and this week my aunt reminded me that she and I were temporarily, and obviously accidentally, part of Dodie Fayed's funeral.
And I'm Jen Offord, and Clive Owen indirectly sponsored me to run the London Marathon.
Later on, Suze Kempner talks about how to be pals with people that have widely different views to you.
I get excited about TV comebacks, namely The League of Gentlemen and Alan Partridge, Jurassic Park.
And I natter to Claire Balding about the changing game of women's sport and her new children's book.
Sarah's back answering another live question posed by one of you lovely lot.
And I do Disney's Frozen.
But first, cakes, Brexit and inappropriate millinery. It's time for The Bush Telegraph. Cue Sting.
Bush Telegraph. Welcome to the Bush Telegraph, where we slap on loads of black eyeliner, widen our peepers and tilt our head at the news with the savviness of a woman who really wants that divorce.
President of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, surprised no one this week by criticising the UK's Brexit negotiations. Juncker took a pop at Brexit Secretary David Davis, saying that none of the papers published by UK government had been, and I quote, satisfactory. Davis, we imagine, has spent the last 14 months too busy laughing about the fact that anyone would give him a position in the cabinet to actually crack on and try to stop us looking like twats. Hoping to make some political capital out of the government's completely predictable ineptitude this week, Labour's shadow Brexit Secretary, Keir Starmer, offered a glimmer of hope for those whose plummeting house prices were starting to get them down. Starmer revealed the party would keep the UK in the single market for at least a transitionary post-Brexit period of, we presume, around 500 years until negotiations have concluded. Keen to maintain his position as people's princess, Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn confirmed the policy but added precious little else.
Over on the Tory benches, Conservative MPs were, presumably, trying not to soil themselves laughing as Prime Minister Teabag revealed that when it comes to the next election, she's in it to win it. No real surprise, given she must be boy to billio at how well the last one went. Oh, wait, no, that's not what happened. And yet, May continues to insist she's not a quitter, parading her authority with all the conviction of the Emperor showing off new clothes, where not only do they not exist, but there's also been trouble in Tummy Town and he's violently shat himself. Someone please hand that woman a wet wipe. Perhaps someone in her zombie government. A clever term deployed by Labour MPs, but let down by the fact that zombies love guts and May doesn't have any.
Meanwhile, in hurricane-battered Houston, ABC reporter Tom Yamas found himself in hot water, which was no doubt preferable to the freezing cold rain, river and backed-up sewer water that many of the city's residents found themselves in. Showing the kind of compassion you'd normally only expect from Paul Ryan, he tweeted that he was witnessing looting at a nearby supermarket and had reported it to the police. Because there's nothing makes you keep clinging to the roof of the car as the flood swirls around you than the knowledge that you can rob as many Cornettos as you like from the one stop if you only make it out of this alive.
Just a heads up to Melania, maybe a cat with FLOTUS emblazoned on the front isn't that great an idea during devastating flooding. Just saying.
Donald Joffrey Trump also sported some eye-catching headwear, visiting the disaster zone wearing a hat you can buy in the foyer. Addressing a group of people flooded out from their homes, he pronounced, "What a crowd! What a turnout!" like someone who had decided to hold their birthday party on a jetty during War of the Worlds.
It feels only patriotic to mention the time our supposedly non-partisan queen absolutely nailed millinery and trolling with that EU hat at this year's state opening of Parliament. Look and learn, Trumps.
North Korea continued to play with its nuclear arsenal, sending a missile sailing over Japan, which was understandably freaked the hell out. Trump tweeted that, and I quote, "Talking was not the answer with North Korea." Dunleavy Bookmaking is currently offering even odds that he thinks the answer is a preemptive nuclear strike and 4.4 million to one that he thinks the answer is interpretive dance.
Never mind Brexit and Trump, the real divisive issue of the year was apparently the Great British Bake Off's new format, which has debuted on Channel 4. The show caused something of a controversy after its producers demanded lots of money from the BBC / licence payer last year in order to keep it on BBC One. Auntie was having none of it though, presumably because she was too busy paying all those men instead, and parted ways with the production company. As the show made its first Channel 4 outing, Unbelievably, controversy did not focus around whether or not new presenter Sandy Toksvig's shirt was as leery as one of Mary Berry's bomber jackets. We're a fan of both, by the way. Instead, one of the great talking points in appropriately British style was advert breaks. Apparently bored with being furious about Princess Diana and the fact that EastEnders has been proper shit for about 18 months now, viewers took to Twitter to vent their frustration. Channel 4 trying to make adverts all cutesy and bacon fun like yum 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 capitalism, said one, who had apparently forgotten how TV works in the UK, as well as the economy in the Western world, and indeed the entire point of the programme, adding, but it's not fucking Mel and Sue, is it?
Also proving divisive is the decision to remake Lord of the Flies, William Golding's classic post-war tale of toxic masculinity, with an all-female cast. So, Mean Girls with seashells and a hog roast, basically. And this despite the fact Lord of the Flies has very recently been remade by Real Life and set in the White House. We're all for more roles for women, but it's a move about as wide of the mark as when people believe Donnie John Trump would keep his pre-election promise to look after women, or the Time Back to the Future Part 2 predicted Princess Di would be Queen in 2015. To add insult to a fucking stupid idea, two men, Scott McGeehy and David Siegel, will be deciding what would happen if a group of girls were left to fend for themselves on an island. Great. Next up, Saving Private Rhiannon, penned by a couple of Nazis, so we can see World War II with fresh eyes.
And now to Australia, which we've not yet visited in the Bush Telegraph, despite it being largely Bush itself. After last month's claim that he had once missed voting on a bill because he was passed out on his office sofa, full o' wine, you'd think that the former Aussie Prime Minister Tony Abbott might be keeping a low profile. But fuck that, he's just announced he's coming over to give the annual lecture to, you've guessed it, a London-based horde of climate sceptics. How do people like him keep getting into power? Who is voting for these fucking people?
I didn't vote for him, or Trump, or May.
No, me either.
Okay, cleared well that up. Yeah. Brace yourselves, there's a new term being bandied around when it comes to the physical act of sweet, sweet heterocoitus. Outer course. That's right. Outer course. Sex therapist Dr. Janet Hall explains it's kissing, massaging, using vibrators, touching erogenous zones, clitoral stimulation, oral sex or toe sucking, basically everything else that might come with sex but isn't penetration. Which is essential to female pleasure because us birds don't tend to get off solely through some pork sword play, however masterful. The penis, it turns out, is not a magic orgasm one for women. You don't fucking say. We're fairly confident this has been said, oof, a billion times, and that all of the lesbians listening are presumably now doing an excellent impression of the dog from the Churchill ads while laughing their expertly pleasured lady bits off. That there's a gender orgasm gap in hetero sex is hardly news, but by positing outer course as a catchy new sex trend rather than a vital part of female pleasure, it buys into the myth that straight folk fucking is all about getting the bloke's rocks off. Thanks, sex ed. Thanks, porn. Thanks, Hollywood. Thanks a bunch. As of now, I'm renaming Outer Course of Fucking Course.
Well, you have equal pay, but, you know, they're not equal, are they?
Sexism of the week.
It's that time of the week where we get all judgy about sexism as if we're at the swimsuit round of a beauty pageant and have just clocked a size 10. A size 10? The mind boggles, the stomach churns, the chins do a special dance soon to be seen on Strictly. Zoe Smale won the chance to represent the UK at Miss United Continents pageant and was definitely going to go until she was told she needed to, and I quote, go on a diet plan as she was too big. And so she bailed and handed her crown back to make a point.
Although it's good to see sexism called out, it's a bit like if one of those white supremacist twats with the tiki torches in Charlottesville had used the M-word and a fellow bigot had said, come on now, Cletus, that's a bit strong.
Size 10, though, she needs to have a word with herself.
And in a spot of real-life reporting from the mean streets of Cambridge, I this week had to endure my own sexism of the week when I attempted to buy a bit of kit for this very podcast from a well-known electrical retailer. After telling the salesman what the cable was for, he repeatedly said, if he wants to do this and if he needs it for this, despite the fact that I told him twice it was for me. Now, I'm the first person to admit I don't always know what I'm talking about when it comes to technical whatnotery, but to assume that a man, my husband, my boss, my son, must be the end user got right on my tits, literally. So I scuttled from the shop in shame. Of course I didn't. I gave him a short lesson in sexism and took my business elsewhere. It's a particularly dumb attitude for any retailer to take, especially given I co-produce a podcast with a section called Sexism of the Week. Hi, guys, at Matt Lynn. You might want to update your customer service policies or, you know, stop being sexist.
Hi, I'm Suze Kempner, a comedian, and here is my guide to how Labourites and Tories can be friends. The frosty atmosphere at various dinner parties I've attended in the past 2 years suggests that, as Labour and the Tories move further apart from each other politically, it's getting tougher for the right and the left to be friends. I remember just a few years ago when the choice when voting was for the neoliberal hugger-hoodie Tories or the neoliberal sure but the minimum wage should definitely be a thing Labour Party, which is why in 2010 I voted for the Lib Dems. Haha, thanks a lot, Nick Clegg. I'm so glad I got up an hour early to vote for you. Haha. After a particularly virulent row with family friends who said, "Just wait and see," about Brexit too many times, brackets once, I found myself wistfully looking back on that magical time when politics was boring and you really could say, "The main parties are all the same," without looking like a poorly read dickhead. Seriously, who still says politicians are all the same anymore? You sound ridiculous. Read literally anything. I hate to lose friendships, but it's hard to find ways to not argue with people who align themselves with shit Thatcher, which is what I call Theresa May, because she's like Thatcher, but shit. Imagine being a shit Thatcher. That's like being a shit England football team in the 80s when they were bad. Like that. That's what Theresa May is to me. Only hating the poor more than 80s footballers hated the poor. I'm basing this on Gary Lineker, who seems very nice. I was told to keep this piece impartial, and I think I'm doing a great job. Right, so I wanted to find ways to remain friends with our Tory acquaintances, so here are my top 5 activities you can do with a Tory that won't end in a terrible, terrible row. Number 1. Make a lasagna. Oh, wow, there's no better way to celebrate how multi-layered us human beings are than with everyone's favourite multi-layered food item. As you and your Tory friend layer up pasta sheets, bechamel sauce, and mince sautéed with tomatoes, onions, and if you fancy it, mushrooms and peppers. I don't know, put what you like in a lasagna. I'm not here to control you. I'm not the Tory government who awarded 10 creationist bigots £1.5 billion after saying there was no magic money tree for literally their entire campaign. While making the lasagna together, you'll be reminded of how human beings are more than just their politics. We are complex creatures, and it'll be hard to fight with someone as you tuck into your Italian dish, which we probably won't even be able to eat anyway once Brexit is finalised, so thanks a lot, Tory friend. Jesus Christ, why do you want to ruin dinner? Number 2. Watch a video of the 1983 election night coverage. 9 hours of Tory landslide goodness for your right-wing friend to savour. It's all on YouTube. And while you both watch, you can be silently smug about the fact that Corbyn's massive gains in Theresa May's snap election prove that Corbyn's leadership is not a repeat of the Michael Foote era, actually. And your friend can sit and scoff about how Labour never learn and you won't need to fight because you'll know you're 100% correct anyway and your friend is just a big wrong Tory. Number 3. Just slag off Nigel Farage. In my experience, your average Tory homie hates Nigel Farage, so just bond over how much you hate him. To avoid a row, wait till the very last second of their front door closing as you leave, before yelling, "Theresa May is just as bad though," and then really fucking run to your car. Number 4. Ooh, running, you say. Have a race. Your Tory friend has probably got a massive living room leading into a massive garden, so open up those French windows, don't mention they're French, just refer to them as windows or glass doors to avoid angering your friend, and challenge Tory pal to a race. While you're running laps, you'll be too focused and worn out to argue, especially if you're currently reliant on food banks, which if the Tories have their way will all be by 2020. Number 5. Get really drunk on British gin. If you're drinking a fine British alcohol, there's no danger of you accidentally saying something nice about foreigners, e.g., this German wine is delicious, thanks Germany, which would only cause your Tory chum to explode with anger and destroy nearby furniture. Instead, the two of you can just kick back with our nation's finest export. And who has ever had a fight when drunk? Exactly, absolutely nobody. And with Nazis literally marching in the streets due to the centre-right pandering to disenfranchised voters and literally giving racism an acceptable voice in 2017, can you afford not to drink until you forget your friend aligns herself with this party? I mean, what the fucking
So there you go.
Five totally argument-proof ways you and your favourite Tory can hang out without it ending in acidic, livid tears. Remember, as society crumbles to keep the rich rich and ensure the poor know their place, we're all going to need our friends. I guess there is such a thing as society, Tory friend. Yeah? Think on that. Maybe read something other than the Mail and the Telegraph and think about how things are actually pretty great for you. Maybe crying about the prospect of nationalised trains makes you look fucking stupid.
I've been Suze Kempner, and this entire piece is fictional. Any resemblance to situations or actual people that I actually know, living or dead, is purely coincidental. After all, I'm left-wing, so I just live in a bubble, right?
You can find me on Twitter, at SuzeUK, that's SOOZUK, and my Edinburgh show, Suze on Film, about how movies change your life, is being performed in London several times this autumn. Check out www.suzekempner.co.uk for details. Please.
Hi, I'm Jen, which you already know because you've already listened to the Bush Telegraph, and potentially you've already listened to Jenny Off the Blocks, and if you haven't, that's coming up, so spoiler alert for you there. As people in the business of caring about gender equality, as us here at Standard Issue are indeed, and generally just as human beings, it should be a fact of grave concern that suicide remains the biggest single killer of men under 50 in the UK. And for me personally, it is a subject of close to my heart because I lost my eldest brother to suicide 13 years ago. In fact, it was sort of after losing my brother that made me think a lot more about gender equality, because I was only 21 when it happened, so it wasn't something I'd actually thought about too much at that point in my life. And it sort of gave me a whole new perspective because, of course, it's not just women that suffer from gender inequality. It is men as well. Unless you've been hiding under a rock this week, or you just made the fairly sensible decision not to be on Facebook, you'll have found it really hard to avoid seeing some of those clips from the Channel 4 News interview with Robert Webb, in which he talks about some of those issues a bit more. It occurred to me because after it happened, I was a young woman at the time, but I had a lot of support from female friends and male friends, and even if my male friends didn't really know what to say to me, because we were only 21, so we were little pups really, but they could just give me a hug. But it seemed to me that my other brother, even though he had close friends as well, maybe society just wasn't kind of built that way for him and his friends to express themselves in that same kind of supportive way. Anyway, with this in mind, it's World Suicide Prevention Day on Sunday the 10th of September. So I took the opportunity to meet up with Sue Royal from the Samaritans to talk about what's being done in terms of suicide prevention, why it needs to be done, and what support is out there for people who may be feeling they need it. Sue, thanks very much for joining us, and at quite short notice as well.
Thank you for the opportunity.
It is World Suicide Prevention Day on Sunday, the 10th of September. First of all, suicide is still overwhelmingly the biggest killer of men under 50, according to the Samaritans or other sources cite slightly different ages, but around that ballpark age. Is there any particular reason for that?
Well, first of all, suicide is complicated. It's never down to just one thing. Samaritans, who are part of the National Suicide Prevention Alliance, in 2012 we put out a report on men and suicide. And there are some things which can impact upon men particularly. One of them is a gold standard of masculinity, and men sometimes think that they have to conform to a particular stereotype to be successful, as in making loads of money, having a great job, having a wife and family, being very successful. And if they see themselves as having failed at that, if, for example, they are involved in a divorce, if they lose their job, if they never feel they've achieved very much in the first place, that could be one of a number of reasons that people can feel suicidal. And often there are other things as well that can be an influence, such as men sometimes tend to have not such a supportive network of friends as women, and they may not necessarily talk to them about emotional things. We're generalising, which is never fantastic, but anecdotally, the report found that a lot of the men that they interviewed had issues like that, that they might have been made redundant, they might have been very worried about money, they might have been divorced and separated from their children and felt that they'd failed at the main relationship that they'd ever had, and they felt very isolated and lonely. So those are all things that could influence people to start struggling and feeling very low and then not knowing where to turn for help. Women are expected to be more emotional, and people tend, I don't like to generalise too much, but people tend to be less comfortable with male emotion. For example, if men cry, that's maybe felt to be less acceptable, and it shouldn't be like that. So the other thing is for us to maybe destigmatise male emotion in some way, if we can, and that people should be more accepting of it. I think we maybe progress has been made, but we obviously need to go further in this area.
Is this something that you see on a sort of global level, or society is sort of set up in this way where men aren't really allowed to talk about their problems on a global level, or is that a British stiff upper lip thing?
It's not necessarily British. I can't speak too much for the rest of the world. I think it does vary. I think in some countries the suicide rate is higher among women, but here it's more than three times more likely for men to kill themselves than women. The National Suicide Prevention Alliance, which has 160 members, is co-chaired by Samaritans and Rethink Mental Illness, is really wanting to speak with one voice. It was set up in 2013. The main aim is to raise awareness of suicide prevention and the need for it, and also to get things done, to lobby the government, lobby local authorities to have suicide prevention plans, and also to provide support and examples of best practice for organisations like the police, like local authorities, like charities working in the field, so we can all work together and improve suicide prevention and hopefully change people's lives and save their lives. That's part one of the main things behind World Suicide Prevention Day, is that we want to raise awareness and get as many people involved in suicide prevention as possible, because suicide is everybody's business.
I lost my own brother to suicide about 13 years ago now, but the staggering thing about it is, you know, no one really talks about it very much, but when you do start talking about it, it's really mind-blowing the number of people you know, actually, who are affected, who also aren't talking about it, but the number of people that have been affected by suicide, who have lost someone to suicide, is quite shocking, actually, I've found. Suicide Prevention Day, obviously, big opportunity to raise awareness. What is it about? Is there anything more to it than just raising awareness? What's the point of it?
Well, certainly the NSPA members are taking part in different events. One of them is the Great North Run, so people will be involved in that. Obviously, it's a big thing on social media, and I would urge people to look out for the hashtag WSPD and to retweet. We have got some plans for sharing material, and the theme is Take a Minute, Change a Life. What I would say is that it's very easy to connect with other people. Sometimes we don't do it enough. There is a stigma around suicide, which obviously the NSPA and the member organisations are doing their best to reduce. And obviously the stigma prevents people speaking out and asking for help when they're struggling, which is obviously something that it's a barrier to help. And so we would like to break that barrier down if we can. One of the things that's really important is letting people know all the places they can go for help. If you go to the NSPA website, which is www.nspa.org.uk, you can find local resources where there are people who you can talk to, who can give you advice. The NSPA has a particular remit to support people who've been affected by suicide and also point them in the right direction when they're seeking help.
So if you've lost someone to suicide yourself, there's that resource is available to you?
Yes. Yes, it certainly is. But if you are struggling about anything, there's different organisations that you can talk to. Obviously, there's Samaritans. I think Calm also have a helpline and they're members of the NSPA. Also, if you're a younger person, Papyrus is also a support organisation for people who are struggling and also people who've been affected by suicide. And there are lots of other organisations on the website, so you can go on it and search for help.
What would you advise someone to do if they know someone who they're concerned about with regards to suicide or potentially doing harm to themselves? What would you advise someone to do if they're worried about someone?
We're always worried about having those conversations. How do we start them? But you can start them very simply. And the general rule is to ask open questions. So instead of asking something which you might get a yes or a no answer to, which closes things down, you can say things like, maybe, how are you feeling about that now? Would you like to talk to me about it? Can I help you? And when people reply to you, you can repeat back what they've said. Like, they might say, oh, I'm feeling really down about it. You could say, so you're feeling really down. Shall we talk a bit more about that? And just encourage them to open up, because sometimes it's a real relief for people to open up and talk about their feelings. And when you're having the conversation, if you concentrate on feelings rather than events and get them to talk about theirs, and then you could, if you feel it's appropriate, maybe talk to them about, have you thought about seeking help about this? How do you feel about talking to somebody about it? Could I come with you? Can I talk to you about organisations that might be able to support you? And in that way, it can flow quite naturally.
If you are someone who feels they need support themselves, what would you advise them to do?
Never be afraid of reaching out for help. The people who you'll be talking to will have heard all sorts of things before. Never feel it's too trivial to call. One of the things that is really helpful is that if people reach out when they're beginning to struggle rather than waiting till they're in crisis, because it can be harder to help people when they're in crisis. Mm. If you are able to do that, there is a lot of help out there that you can access, and don't feel afraid to talk. As I've said, the people who are on the other end of the line, or if you're emailing somebody, they will have experienced all sorts of things and they'll be trained. And there are a lot of places you can go where you can be anonymous, so people aren't going to know that you've sought help. So that is the main thing I would say, really. Don't be afraid to reach out. There is a lot of help available.
Thank you very much, Sue, for talking to us. The Samaritans are available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and can be reached on 116123 on the phone, or you can email joe@samaritans.org. The NSPA's website also has a lot of resources available, as Sue said earlier.
Yes, it's www.nspa.org. UK.
And for all of this information and to donate to the very vital work of the Samaritans, please go to their website, which is www.samaritans.org. Thanks very much, Sue.
Hannah Dunleavy's Outside the Box. Hi, it's that time again where I make like Donald Trump and talk exclusively about things I have seen on TV. And this week, I'm going to be talking about comedy. Partly because listening to me ruminate on what the hell went wrong between Series 1 and Series 2 of Top of the Lake would not be fun. But mostly because there's been all sorts of what I can only describe as big news in the world of TV comedy. First up, Channel 4 and Michaela Cole announced there would not be a third series of Chewing Gum. If you're disappointed, you're not alone. Channel 4 sounded a little despondent too, with the decision apparently coming from Cole herself, as is her prerogative. There's no point rushing or half-assing a third series if she's got other plans for her time, and I'm pretty sure what comes next from her, regardless, will be more than worthy of my time. And after all, you never know, because in recent weeks, some dormant comedies have erupted back into life. No, I'm not happy with that image either, but I started that analogy and I had to end it somewhere.
The return of the brilliantly batshit The League of Gentlemen is unsurprising in its 20th anniversary year, and although previously confirmed by both Mark Gatiss and Steve Pemberton, the BBC's announcement that yes indeed there were three new episodes arriving soon was nonetheless cause for excitement. There's no point me extolling the virtues of The League of Gentlemen years after the fact. You either love it, and you know why you love it, or you don't, and I don't know what I can do to help you. Personally, I friggin' love it, even the much-debated third series and the off-scorned film, mostly because both contained a huge dash of Jeff Tips, a creation of utter comedy genius. I'm not sure anyone does comedic anger as well as Reese Shearsmith.
Your mum died and mine didn't! I won that. At least I won the mums!
In fact, one of my two favourite episodes of any comedy series ever is Turn Again Jeff Tips, the result, presumably, of a thunderbolt labelled Let's Make Jeff Try Stand-Up Comedy. The only other serious competitor for my favourite comedy episode ever would be The Colour of Alan.
Watch yourself, you're nearly 50.
You're going to say I was nearly 50 then? Right, we're nearly 50 then, but at least I can make the
what?
Lil have pierced my foot on the spine.
So it's maybe fitting that the other big comedy news is that Steve Coogan will be returning to the BBC for the first time in 15 years to make a new series or A Partridge Among the Pigeons or something similarly freaking great, no doubt. Partridge will return in 2018 in a series that will apparently explore the Spoof character's newfound role as the voice of hard Brexit. And that's all I need to know, to be honest. If you're interested, other single episodes of comedy series of which I am ridiculously fond include the IT Crowd's The Workouting.
Hum one of the songs.
Willies, Willies, I like Willies.
I love Willies. Oh. I love Willies.
Scott, could you keep it down?
Aisle 8A from King of the Hill when Connie starts her period while in the care of Hank. Rosemary's Baby, the 30 Rock episode in which Liz makes the mistake of meeting her idol, who is played by Carrie Fisher.
Help me, Liz!
And, of course, Blackadder's run-in with the Bishop of Bath and Wales in Money. That's me for this month. If you want to point out any individual episodes of TV guaranteed to make you wee your trouser washing pants, then tweet me. I'm at that Dunleavy. And if you find yourself wanting something to fill 20 minutes or an hour this week, Channel 4 has a full-length version of Krishnan Gurram Murphy's brilliant interview with actor and writer Robert Webb on its website. Or you can watch actor and director Noel Clarke's episode of Who Do You Think You Are on the BBC iPlayer, both of which are really warm, really open and really feminist chunks of TV. Until next time.
Bring it.
Question?
I'm not answering that. Hello, this is Sarah Milliken, and you are listening to Sarah Milliken's Question Time. If you can hear something, then it's possibly an owl, because I'm doing this at night, and there's sometimes an owl outside, which makes me shit my pants. I've got a couple of good questions this week, both from Twitter. The first is from Paula Bowler. I'm going to say bowler, like bowler hat. It might be bowler, but I think if it was bowler, you would change it to bowler, wouldn't you? Anyway, thanks, Paula. Paula's question, can opener in hand, what would be your go-to canned produce in the underground bunker? Now, it's a good question. I'm wondering, first of all, if I have to... Do I have to provide for other people? Do I have to think of what the majority of people would like? Or am I in an underground bunker on my own? Which I think I'd like for like a day, and then after that I'd get really lonely and I'd draw a face on a wall and talk to that, like in the Tom Hanks film Castaway. If it was just me, I'd just have beans, but I've realised I've got no way of warming it up because I have very rudimentary cooking skills in an actual functioning kitchen, let alone in an underground bloody bunker. So in that case, I might just do peaches. Because then I could have cold custard as well. Can I have tins of... I don't know why I'm asking you. You're not providing it, presumably, Paula. Can I have tins of custard, ambrosia custard, obviously. I'm not a monster. And tins of peaches. And then I'm happy for, like... I mean, I don't know if I'd want to start, you know, making babies with strangers, that kind of underground bunker, but I'm certainly happy to survive a good couple of hours in there with some lovely pudding. Excellent question, Paula, thank you. I've got another question. Oh, that was a cat noise. Oh, Brodie's... I'm under a duvet, Brodie, you're gone. I'm under a duvet because apparently this is really good, but the cat doesn't understand and he's trying it. Oh, he's just turned my computer off. How did you do that? I've got another question. This is from James Mackin. Hiya, James. And James's question is, have you seen a ghost? I think I have. I was once told on television by a science man that I definitely hadn't, because he clearly has been in my eyes for my entire 42 years. I think I have. I once saw an old lady walk out of my sister's bedroom door, and I told my sister, and she she was horrified by this, and it frightened her. So she, to pay me back, told me a story she was never supposed to tell me, which was that when my dad once trapped a mouse in a mouse trap, it not only did it die, but its eyes came out on stalks. And she wasn't supposed to tell me that because she's the older sister and she was supposed to protect me because I love animals. And she knew, obviously my parents knew that would give me nightmares. So she told me when I told her about the ghost instead. So while I have seen a ghost, it's not something I shop around a lot, because some people think you're mad and other people tell you about eyes out on stalks. Anyway, both excellent questions. Thank you both very much. And have a lovely week, guys. Bye-bye. If you'd like me to answer one of your questions, then tweet us at StandardIssueUK using the hashtag SMQT. Thank you.
Standard Issue for all women.
You play ball like a girl!
Go on, do one, kid. Jenny Off the Blocks. Welcome to Jenny Off the Blocks. I'm Jen. Which hopefully you know, and if you didn't, then, well, you do now. But anyway, this is our weekly gallop along the home straight of women's sport. Recording this in my bedroom, so you're going to hear some loud cars from time to time, because that's how we roll on busy roads in Stoke Newington. So, to open things up this week, I've got to pose the question, where did it all go wrong, lads? First the football with the women's Euros, then the hockey with the World Championships, then the Rugby World Cup. Now Joe Konter is out in the first round of the US Open, and Lizzie Danan is a question mark for the Road Cycling World Championships after undergoing surgery to remove her appendix. Fuck sticks. Still, at least all of these events were actually reported by the press, and let's face it, as Brits, we wouldn't have a bastard clue what to do with ourselves if we actually won any sporting events. Moving swiftly on to this week's main event in Jenny Off the Blocks, I caught up with Claire Balding. Claire Balding, a couple of weeks ago back at the Edinburgh Festival, where she was talking about her new children's book. So we had a little chat about being a national treasure, exciting times for women's sports, and the very same children's book, The Racehorse Who Disappeared. Keep your ears peeled for the full interview, which will follow in this week's Sunday Chops. I'm a bit nervous, actually, Claire, because you do this job for a living and you are considerably more experienced than I am, and you're sort of who I want to be when I grow up.
Oh, so, that's nice. So, oh, I love... Maybe. No, that's a very good way to start. Flattery will get you everywhere. and obviously immediately taking the sort of... You're like a dog who's just rolled over on its back and said, tickle my tummy, please, and then lick my hand, saying, I love you, I love you, I love you. It's very sweet.
So that's a cracking start. I am going to call you a national treasure, Claire, because I think you're making a face at me, and I know that's probably like slightly uncomfortable to hear in some respects, but I think it's fair to say, because you are a woman who talks about sport for a living, and people seem to be largely okay with that. So I want to know, Claire, your secret?
Well, I know, I think you have to do a lot more than that to be regarded as a national treasure. I also think you have to have worked in your chosen industry for at least 50 years before you get that. But I was doing something for the National Trust recently. I was doing their podcast for their Prejudice and Pride season. And I was one of the guys there said, but you're a national treasure. And I said, no, I'm not. But if you wanted to do National Trust treasures and you had a rotating list of like 20 every year, I'd work really hard to get on it to get free National Trust membership for a year. And he looked at me and he went, that's a really good idea. I said, you can have it. I said, in fact, I can suggest your first 20, but you need promotion and relegation to make this quite competitive. So Judy Dench is straight in, but she might get relegated at the end of the year, you know, if she actually gets caught shoplifting like Tracy Ullman depict her.
You know, you never know what's going to happen.
No, exactly. And Helen Mirren, obviously, straight in there. And there are loads of others. But I would, you know, I'd be fighting with, I don't know, Catelyn Moran and Kate Winslet for the spot at the bottom, you know? Get in.
I just wanted to ask you a bit about how you got into that world in the first place.
My dad was a racehorse trainer, so I grew up surrounded by horses. And he also was an all-round sportsman. So to have a conversation with him, I had to watch a lot of cricket to know what to talk to him about, or watch a lot of rugby, or watch the golf. And therefore, I got interested in it, really as a way of desperately seeking his attention. And then I was mad for horses, so I wanted to go to the Olympics and ride as an event rider. That was my aim. That's not a way to make a living unless you're a really good dealer in horses. Actually, that's how most of them make their living, because there's no prize money in it. And then I went off to university. I read English. I desperately wanted to write, and I got a job on a newspaper. So the first thing I did was I worked for The Sporting Life back in, I don't know, 94 or something, and I wrote columns for them about Sunday racing, which had just started. And then I got asked to do a voice test for Five Live. Somebody said to me, "Have you thought about radio?" And they were looking at me really intently, and it was a man. And I thought, "Oh God, this is going to be really awkward, because he's looking at me really strangely. He's going to ask me something in a minute, and I don't know what to say." And then he said, "Have you thought about using your voice?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, come in and do a voice test. I need to hear you on a microphone." He said, "You've got a very deep pitch, and that might work very well for radio." And that was it. So I started doing racing bulletins, and then I was a trainee in BBC Sport and did all sorts of other things. They took me away from racing completely and said, "Well, you can do everything else, but not racing. We want you so far out of your comfort zone that we work out whether you're any good or not." And that's what they did.
Well, speaking a bit about the many, many things that you have now done for BBC Sport and various other places, you've just come back from the Women's Euros,
yeah,
which must have been incredible. What kind of changes have you seen in that?
Well, it's the first time I've presented football. So for me, it was a massive opportunity. And you know, I said about my training taking me out of my comfort zone. This year was the first year for 20-something years that I haven't presented racing. So ITV got the contract at the beginning of the year, and I'm not in the ITV team, which is fine, because actually it forced me to look at what do I care about? What do I want to do? And obviously women's sport I have tried and campaigned on behalf of women's sport for many years. But to get the chance to present women's football, the biggest sport in this country, football is generally, the biggest capacity for growth, because I think a lot of girls in a lot of schools don't realise they could have a career in football. So there's all that untapped potential. And as you say, the starting of this blossoming of the game in terms of investment, you know, Manchester City doing what they're doing, and Arsenal still being really strong and active, Chelsea also having a really good setup, and other clubs trying to emulate them. It's a very exciting time. And an England team that had come back from the World Cup having finished third, an England team that knew that on their best day they could actually beat anybody in the world, and an England team that went there with a real hope and chance of winning the title. Now, it didn't work out that way, but until the semi-final, they played such exciting football, and people got to know them, and Jodie Taylor became a star, and she did win the Golden Boot, but they could actually name Steph Horton and Lucy Bronze and Fran Kirby, and there were suddenly players that you knew a bit more about, and people started to care. And for me, the key to sport broadcasting sport, is give people a reason to care. This is not just about a result, and it's not just about kicking the ball. It's about the characters, the personalities on the pitch. And with men's football, obviously, it's being talked about all the time. Unfortunately, you can't not care, because it is the constant conversation. And it doesn't matter whether it's a conversation about... It's more often than not, it's about money. It's conversations about, will a player be transferred? How much for? How much is he earning? You know, is he injured? How much damage will that do to the club? And I think women's football has a chance to be better than that, actually. And I think there's a lot about women's football that men's football could learn from and benefit from. And what was lovely about being out in the Netherlands, I walked on the Sunday of the final, so it's the Netherlands against Denmark in the final, and I walked with the fan walk from Enschede. I didn't go the whole way to the stadium, but I did a significant part of it. And there were thousands of people around me, and most of them dressed in orange, but a fair few dressed in red and white and with big Viking horns on. You know, the Danes were there in force. And it was joyful. and it felt safe and warm and friendly, and you could not do that at a men's football tournament, certainly not if England fans are around. And there was a real feeling, I think, of the beauty and the purity of what football could be in a better world, what it could be and should be.
Is that because women are just better than men?
I actually feel sorry for a lot of male football fans, because most male football fans are not violent, are not homophobic, do not go to a match to literally sit and taunt the opposition fans. There are, you go to some matches, let's say you went to Spurs-Arsenal, there would be a section of fans who are there only to chant abuse at their rival fans. And I don't understand that. So there's something very, very Stone Age about that to me. And that small group of people completely tainted for everyone else. I think the vast majority of football fans are perfectly decent human beings. And it's very expensive to follow men's football. Yeah. And I think women's football will get a bigger and bigger audience because it's good to watch, because you're starting to know the characters, because the Women's Super League is going to get better and better. You've got, you know, really good players from abroad coming. A lot of them were actually, I mean, we've got some good American players coming, but also there were a lot of those Dutch players play in our league. And it was really interesting to me to see all these names that I thought, oh, she plays for Arsenal, she plays for Chelsea. Van der Sanden, who was fantastic all the way through for the Dutch, plays for Liverpool. And Liverpool aren't a particularly strong force in women's football, but you know you can see her. I think that's really exciting. And you know, I feel the same way about women's tennis. The better Jo Konta gets and the more consistent she is at Grand Slams, the more we care about her opponents, because the more we know about them. And that's part of the, you know, you've got to make it an intense experience. Sport rewards you the more you know. And you look at the World Championships, the athletics, and that women's 4x100 team and the men's 4x1, they're really young. It's a really exciting time. And for all the doom and gloom of, oh, you know, Mo Farah's retiring, Greg Rutherford's injured, Jess Ennis-Hill has retired, there's suddenly this new band. They were youngsters when London 2012 was happening, and they are now the ones who are going to be standing on the podiums instead of carrying kit. And that, I think, is really exciting. I love that feeling of fresh growth on the trees, you know?
There's a lot happening at the moment, and, as you say, it's not just... It's not just women's football, but I thought it's quite interesting. I'm sure you'd have seen this the other day. There was an event for the Grenfell Disaster Fund, and I think it was Jackie Oatley actually was chairing it. And Arsene Wenger, the Arsenal manager, was on the panel, and he was asked a question about female managers. Do we think there'll be female managers in the Premier League anytime soon? And he said yes, he thought there would be. What do you think?
I would love Kelly Smith, for example, who's going through her coaching badges at the moment, and has probably got a year to go before she's fully qualified. The greatest England striker ever, more goals than any England footballer, male or female. And she was an Arsenal stalwart, but also played in America. I think a lot of the good female players have a broader experience and a broader life experience. Kelly had to work nearly all her life, because professionalism only happened at the end of her career. A bit like Charlotte Edwards in cricket, same thing. They are the pioneers who, unfortunately, themselves haven't benefited from it, but get a huge amount of satisfaction of what they created and the level they raised the game to allow it to be considered professional. And then the investment came in, and now the players are paid. And they're not paid, you know, in terms of men in cricket or football. Obviously, the pay is you can't compare it. But it's a start. I don't want women's football to turn into men's football on any level. I think women's cricket is a really good model, and full credit to Claire Connor at the ECB, who was a great player herself and an England captain. And she's come through into a really important role of organising it. Judy Murray believes that is the key to successful women's sport. You've got to have women in those controlling positions where they're making the decisions. So whether that's coaching, managing, or chief exec, or organising the schedule. I mean, God, the schedule for the Women's Super League and the promotion of it and the regularity of the dates and times of kickoff is terrible. It's really terrible. You've got to give people a structure and a timetable. Let them know when these things are happening, because you can't just guess. And you might get a game. Yeah, turn up at 4, see what's happening. No, it doesn't work like that. Anyway, to get back to your point, yes, I would love to see women in more powerful roles across football.
I have read The Racehorse Who Wouldn't Gallop, and it is the most charming book. So when I first heard about this book, actually, I automatically assumed Charlie was a boy, and Charlie is not. Charlie's a little girl. And I wondered if Charlie had a sort of a gender-neutral name. Was that on purpose?
Yeah, it is deliberately gender-neutral, and she has short hair. Now, she's a 10-year-old girl with short hair. I promise you, and I go into a lot of schools, you cannot find a girl between the age of 7 and 27 with short hair. It is so hard. And actually, the football was really interesting because the only two I saw with short hair were Shanice van der Sanden for the Dutch and Fran Kirby for England. I think there is an underlying issue there of femininity equals long hair, and whether it's because of princesses in cartoons and books or whether it's because everybody wants to look like Kate Middleton, I don't know, but they all want long hair and you can't be a girl and have short hair. And I just think, God, I mean, I'm not sort of fighting for it because I've got short hair. It's nothing to do with that. I remember looking at our school photo and everyone had different hair. We all had dreadful hair, but everybody had different hair. We didn't all look the same. And apparently, teachers say you want to look at the Facebook page, you know, profile page. They all look the same. And I just want to stand up for individuality. Don't be afraid to be different. Don't be afraid to stand out from the crowd. We don't have to all look the same. And you don't have to try and pursue some sort of ideal that you think is perfect femininity. Why can't it just be what you are?
One of the things I loved about it was that it celebrates attributes in the main character, Charlie, that are not often seen as, or they're not celebrated as feminine attributes.
She's a problem solver too, so she has to find it, and her two older brothers are really annoying and they tease her all the time and they body shame her a lot about her big legs, you know, and her mum has to give her a talking to about the women, you know, with powerful legs, and says to her, look at, you know, Boudicca and Queen Victoria and Hillary Clinton and Catherine the Great. And obviously I wrote it before the American election, so I wondered whether to swap out Hillary Clinton. I thought, no, leave her in there. She's got powerful legs. And Beyonce, you know, look at these women. Serena Williams. Yeah. You can be big and strong and powerful, and that's okay. And so I wanted her to have those sort of fears that I do think all girls have and a lot of boys have of what will people think? They'll be looking at me. And the other thing with her is the understanding of an animal. How do I get inside this horse's head to make him want to gallop, to make him want to? How do I try and solve his insecurity and in doing so herself get stronger? And actually in the second book, the one that comes out in September, The Racehorse Who Disappeared, she has to deal with fear and anger. She has to deal with quite a lot of anger. And again, how do you manage that? And she has to be brave. And she is brave. She's a brave little girl. And that's... I wanted...
The other thing about it is it draws on a lot of sort of sports knowledge as well. So there's quite a lot of facts in there, like interesting facts about sport. And it's like a very nice way to introduce that to people who might be reading it just because it's a book about a little girl with a horse. Yeah. Was that a conscious thing as well?
Yes, definitely. So quite a lot of Olympic sports. And also a bit of... understanding the psychology of sports people. So whether it's Victoria Pendleton, who I reference a fair bit, or Charlotte Dujardin, and in the next book I talk a lot about Kate Richardson Walsh and the hockey team and Maddie Hinch and all of that, and how you win matches that you're not expected to win. And I do think there are a lot of lessons from sport, and I like putting in things that are factually satisfying, because I've always said facts are my friend. Everyone loves a stat, and I'm quite nerdy on that, so yeah, I do enjoy doing that.
You do reference in the first book the likes of Beyonce and Victoria Pendleton. Now, Beyonce is my spirit guide of sorts. She doesn't know it. If you're listening, Beyonce, thanks for that. Who do you admire? Who do you look to for inspiration?
I think through my early 20s and probably still now, Ellen DeGeneres, I would look at and think, God, you look at everything she went through. And she says some very sensible things, and I like her show because I think it's kind and it's funny, and I think she has an incredibly high sort of moral standard, and she can pull off the selfie of all selfies as well at the Oscars, and was the best Oscar host ever. I look at her and think, gosh, that she is someone I admire hugely. And then I have other people who are my imaginary best friends, obviously. Kate Winslet, she is, really. Yeah. We were meant to do something together in November. And in the end, actually, I managed to make best friends with Helen Mirren instead. So that's pretty cool. Yeah, that was pretty cool, actually. But I was still upset that Kate wasn't there because I felt, you know, we'd be on holiday now, you know, just as friends, just, you know, hanging out. Probably Christmas as well, you know. Yeah, I think. I mean, I don't see why not. Yeah. But if we make it onto the National Trust treasure list, you see, we can then be friends.
Yeah. Kate, if you're listening, Claire's a national treasure. Come on, sort it out. Claire, thank you so much. It's been an absolute joy to talk to you. When is your book coming out?
September the 17th or 19th, sometime around then, and it's called The Racehorse Who Disappeared, the second one.
And the first one is absolutely brilliant, and buy it, read it to your children, read it to your little girls, your little boys. It's fantastic. Thank you so much, Claire.
Thank you.
Welcome to Dunleavy Does Disney. Dunleavy, what Disney did you do this week?
This week I did Frozen.
Have you seen it before?
I hadn't. No, it was the first time. I've got a lot of friends who are a similar age to me, which means that a lot of them have children that are approximately the age for watching Frozen. So this is probably the Disney film that I hadn't seen that I'd heard most about.
Yep.
And I have to say the reports were generally good. Kids loved it, and the mums were saying things like, you know, it's way better than the usual sexist Disney guff. So I have to say I did have high hopes when I watched it.
The biggest grossing Disney movie ever?
Yeah, no, the grossest Disney movie ever, right, okay. Might be what you're
just
looking for.
Just giving away the conclusion.
Anybody seen it?
I have not seen it, but I have heard an awful lot about it. And I am aware that it is something that makes children fully lose their shit.
It is catnip for small girls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen it, but watched it for this. And I went in as cynical as I could be, which is really quite cynical, and found myself being reluctantly charmed by it, but also probably horrified in equal measure. And my other dealings with Frozen is having worked in a theatre. And in every pantomime they did at Christmas, they would crowbar in "Let It Go," and it just made me want to kill, basically, just run wild with a machete.
I think eventually the "Let It Go" defence will become like the Twinkie defence. It will it will actually be that the defence is that you listen to "Let It Go" loads of times. You were so full of sugar that you it was okay.
That is the best description. It is basically just a sugar rush of a song, isn't it? It's too sweet. It's actually saccharine. It's like sweetener, which gives me the shits.
Nice. Hello, kiddies.
They don't listen to our podcast.
I hope the fuck they don't. No.
Okay, I mean, I'm going to ask this question. I think I already know the answer. Did you like it?
I have to say, for the most part, in fairness, for the most part, it was perfectly watchable. And reports of its quality were largely true. The animation is really, really good.
Oh my God, the Northern Lights and the snow and the ice is amazing.
When she runs across the ice she runs across the lake and it all, fjord, in fact, I think
fjord,
it is.
Fjord, yeah.
And it all starts sort of turning into ice. Yeah, that's really good. The characterisation is actually way better than, like, I mean, we know, how many Disney films have we watched now?
108.
Something like that. The characterisation is really, really good in that characters actually have a personality, and that includes, like, the male characters, that they have a personality. I do have a few reservations.
Really, Hannah?
Which
you
we'll
do surprise
to,
me.
But yeah, the plot, for those who haven't seen it, is actually pretty full. I mean, that's obviously a good thing that it's full, but it does.
Whereas
that
Snow White has.
Yes.
Oh, Cinderella it was.
Cinderella,
wasn't
I ran out of things to say after 20 seconds. But the long and short of it is Elsa and Anna, I've put in brackets there, you know, don't pronounce Anna, they're two princes with impossibly small noses. Like, seriously, the smallest. I don't. There's an open void on their face where their nose would actually be.
Like Skeletor.
And then a tiny little ski run at the end.
No, I think they're both absolutely massive gackheads and they've just lost their septum.
Yeah.
They've just got like a little weird.
So they're not hot like they normally are.
They're fit, but their eyes freak me out, right? They have got like the world's
but
biggest
would you?
Eyes. Not really my bag, mate. I mean, these are princesses.
Oh, right, okay. I thought we were talking about princes now.
Oh, no, the princes, the men in it, all look like John Krasinski. Do you know who he is?
No.
Jim in the American Office. He's married to Emily Blunt.
Okay.
For a fun fact.
Okay.
All the men look like him.
Right.
And have normal-sized noses.
Okay.
But with different hair. Like, they're just like, guess who? Did
so just the women have weird noses.
We have tiny, tiny noses.
Only women are allowed to do coke in Frozen Land.
Well, fair enough, mate. Yeah. That's equality, isn't it?
Isn't it, right?
Or, in fact, let's call it snow for the sake of argument.
Hey!
Anyway, they live in a castle. Elsa has an unexplained superpower to just freeze stuff with her hands or her mind, depending on which way you look at it.
You've never explained your superpower.
What's my superpower?
Remind me.
I don't know. Is it not crying?
Yeah, that is your superpower.
Yeah. I exist in a state of perpetual dehydration. That's why.
Well,
you're just a husk of a woman.
I am.
What were you going to say, Jen?
I don't know. It's gone. It was obviously very important.
Anyway, one night when they're arsing around, when they're kids, inexplicably everybody seems to sleep in their full clothing in this.
Do you want to build a snowman?
Don't. Right? One night, she almost kills her sister with this power, so her parents decide to lock her away.
Accidentally. She accidentally.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Lock her away until she learns to control it, like Renton's parents do in Train Spotting.
Right, yeah.
Which I think we can all learn isn't a great plan. Unfortunately, those parents die before they can see the absolute shit show that results from this terrible parenting choice.
Classic Disney parents death.
Yeah.
We're going on a trip. You're never coming back. Ship crash.
I've remembered
Ship
my crash. Question.
Ship crash.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, as a superpower, how useful that is.
Freezing stuff.
Yeah.
I would imagine if you work at maybe a festival and it's really hot, it would be quite useful.
I'm just going to revert back to the fact that I always fancy cartoon characters and that my first crush was was Iceman from The Amazing Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
Spider-Man and his amazing friends. And that was really cool because he could slide out his own runway, get to places faster.
Technically.
I love a man who can slide out his own runway. Oh, sorry.
Oh, Spunk and Frozen.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you've gone too far. Yeah, well, it's like, is that a slush puppy flavour?
Oh. Anyway, bringing it back to the film. Yeah. So she becomes the queen, Elsa, because she's the oldest one. And on her coronation day, everything goes to hell. Her power is revealed and she plunges the kingdom, which I think is supposed to be Norway, or in the words of the late, great Sean Spicer, Norwegia. She plunges it into some sort of potentially perpetual winter. She runs off to live in an ice castle of her own devising. I can't help but feel some sort of Brexit comparison here. And then her sister goes off to save her. Much stuff happens.
Now, does she mean to throw the kingdom into a perpetual...
No, she isn't aware that she's done it. She thinks she's just made it snow a little bit.
I feel like a lot of this, watching this, I genuinely feel like a lot of this is a euphemism for hormones. I felt like the idea that she couldn't control them, she had to learn to control them.
I was 14 when I first made my house into a perpetual winter. And also got my period. Yeah. Very late starter.
I'd say one of the best things about Frozen, and I can say this as someone who has watched a lot of Disney films recently, is it does subvert the idea that Disney princesses fall in love with and marry the very first man that they meet. Because Anna does meet a man and fall in love with him, and literally everyone says, what the fuck? What? You've just met him. You're going to get married to him, you fucking idiot, in slightly more Disney-esque language, which is pretty much what we were all screaming to Cinderella
every week.
Snow White and everyone. As to the question, what's not to like? It's that motherfucking awful music.
You want to build a snowman?
For a start, there's so much music in it. There's like four songs in the first 20 minutes, right? Do you want to build
a
snowman?
It's the same song. They just keep like repeating
reprising it.
Yeah.
Do you want to build a snowman is insufferably cutesy. I couldn't bear it. Love is an Open Door is so insufferably cutesy. I couldn't bear it. And
is it though?
And actually includes a scene under a waterfall. And as we know, I'm only interested in any scenes under waterfalls if they end with the words, I will find you. Other than that, I don't give a shit. Then there's The First Time in Forever, insufferably cutesy. And we haven't even made it yet, first 20 minutes, to the absolute excruciating power ballad.
Oscar-winning power ballad.
Let it go. The people who wrote this song said they based it on Adele and Amy Mann. And to me, there's nothing Adele and Amy Mann about this. This is full on fucking air grab Celine Dion. It's awful.
This is a song that one of my best friends told me. Her and her mum were babysitting her niece, and she became almost entranced by it. Like, they were actually a bit worried about her because she lost her shit to the extent that they were just like, what the fuck is happening to the child?
It's like it had all the E numbers.
Yeah.
Well, as someone who lives right next door to a school, I can tell you that there is a universal law that says if any microphone is unattended for long enough, a small girl will go and start singing Let It Go into it.
Yeah, there's a small child on my street. I think there's more than one. They all look pretty much the same to me. But the small one, and one, she screams all the time for no reason. So if she ever gets attacked, I just won't know. And two, she sings Let It Go all the time as well. She just discovered singing and she won't shut the fuck up.
This is like, you know, isn't this a few years old now, this film?
Yeah.
It's like, why aren't they fucking over it yet?
Do you want an interesting fact?
Because kids are pricks.
Fact about Let It Go?
Yeah.
Okay, so there isn't a baddie. This is one of the problems with Frozen, is it? It doesn't have a baddie. Mm. And the point is, the baddie was supposed to be Elsa. But they decided to write the song Let It Go in a kind of let's understand her. And then Disney decided to rewrite it that Elsa was more of a victim of her circumstances rather than a baddie. But it does lack a baddie.
There is a baddie. It's just it's supposed to be revealed in a bit of a twist, like three quarters of the way through the film, isn't it?
Yeah, but he doesn't actually have a huge amount of control over what happens for a lot of the film. He doesn't drive it. He's reacting to it. So it certainly doesn't have an antagonist in that case. It does have a couple of plot faults. You know what I'm like with plot faults, and I get very upset about plot faults. The main one of which is...
Sorry. Can we just go back to Elsa? I would have loved to see it if they'd gone with her as the central sort of... I know it's a double central character, but instead of Anna being who we followed, I'd have quite liked to see it be Elsa.
Is her not just ripping her hair off and shaking it around and standing in an ice...
And putting on a sexy dress.
With all of the stylings of a mid-80s Bonnie Tyler video. Was that not enough for you?
If I sleep with my hair in a plait and then just shake it out, I look like I put my finger in an electric plug socket.
Yeah.
It's not a good look. But no. I do always put my sexy sequin gown on as well.
Is that how
get
she
some
becomes...
ice cubes out.
Sorry. Is that how she becomes fit? Is it like taking the glasses off?
Yeah.
Cool.
Absolutely. Yeah.
She's like, you know, Plain Jane in Neighbours?
She's like just shaking her hair down. She throws her crown away.
She lets it
Jen. That's been in fucking her family for generations. But no, she just fucking throws it away. Like, she doesn't care. Okay, so the point of the film is that this is the thing that everyone was praising it. She doesn't get saved. Nobody gets saved by a man. In fact, it's two sisters who manage to save each other. Ah, lovely, smiley, happy. Hello to my sister. The point is that she has to be saved by an act of love.
True love.
True love. And earlier in the film, Olaf, who is actually quite entertaining, I will say, he's quite funny.
He's a snowman.
He's got a touch of donkey in Shrek, but without being as funny. He's the snowman. He offers to sit with Anna when she's really, really sick in front of a fire, even though he will melt. And that, to me, should be enough to have saved her. But obviously it didn't go with the idea that women can save each other, so that wasn't the case. Anyway, but for the most part, actually, it doesn't have too many horrific plot faults, which is very unusual certainly for me watching a film to not be writing a list of them.
I really liked the reindeer and the line, reindeers are nicer than people.
Yeah.
Is that true? Can you corroborate that?
I've stroked a reindeer and their antlers are surprisingly furry, like velvety.
Oh, I don't like that.
What?
I feel like that's wrong.
Why would you not like a velvety antler?
I feel like that's wrong. It's just, I don't like it.
What did you want it to feel like?
I don't know.
Unicorn tears.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I don't, there's something a bit creepy about like a velour.
A velour reindeer? Like velour a Juicy antler. Couture tracksuit.
Yeah. Don't like it.
Yeah. The reindeer is well good in it.
Okay.
He doesn't say anything. He's not anthropomorphised. Well, he is in that he does stuff, but he doesn't talk.
No, he doesn't.
No. He just... That's my reindeer impression. It's pretty good.
That's really good. Yeah.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Thanks. I'm available to hire if you've got any reindeer needs. What score are we giving Frozen, Dunleavy?
Well, I'm a bit torn because, like I say, since I've been critical on other things for their treatment of women, I have to be positive about this for treating women in a slightly more positive fashion. So,
and drug addict women as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. But on the other hand, I fucking hate that music. So I am going to give it 3 power ballad air grabs out of 5.
It's not a bad score. I thought in earlier discussions you mooted a half mark, but it's been docked off. Was that because I did, do you want to build a snowman?
Yeah, that was it. Okay. Literally. Right. A little bit sick came up in my mouth. That's our podcast this week. Thanks very much for listening. You can join us next week. You will join us next week. We have as guests Yosra Osman, who will be talking about whitewashing in Hollywood. I'll also be talking to American comedian Caitlin Brodnick about her brilliant new book, Dangerous Boobies, which is about a preemptive double mastectomy she had. And we'll also be joined by the brilliant Ellie Gibson and Helen Thorne,
better known as Scummy Mummies. We have actually already done that interview, and I can tell you they were a lot of fun. If you want to come to one of our live shows, why the hell wouldn't you? You've missed September's, which we've already had, and it was completely brilliant. We had Olivia Colman and Jenny Clare and Kerry Godleman and Sarah, and it was hosted by our Mick. And it's really good, but don't be too disappointed because that will actually be released as a podcast coming up soon. But if you do want to come to a live show, you know, if you love the smell of the grease paint and all of that stuff, our next one is in London at the Leicester Square Theatre. And our guests are Rebecca Front, Scarlett Moffat and the comedian Evelyn Mock. So that should be really good. Our music was composed by Barry Hilton. So cheers for that, mate. And I think that's all I have to say. So until next week, stay frosty.
Standard issue for all women.